He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora everyone, Ingrid here. Welcome to today's episode of Morning Report Essentials. Lots of big issues discussed today. One that really got people very interested, as always, is the three strikes law. That is back after some tweaks, so plenty of opposition to that. But we had the Prime Minister on talking about, not really talking about evidence, talking about the counterfactuals, which is one of his catchphrases these days. Good to have him back because he wasn't on last week. He was out of the country, but good to have him back and be able to put that to him too.
Yes, indeed. We also had political editor Joe Moyer in for a very interesting explainer on the End of Life Choice Act and a mandatory review which is required for that and what that could look like and mean. That will no doubt be a pretty controversial but important debate to have. And we also spoke to New Zealand's unofficial world record holder for speed golf. 30 minutes for a round of golf.
We got the ins and outs of that. I'm not sure I'm sold, but you sounded pretty keen, Corin.
Well, as I say, I mean, you know, 5 hours for a round of golf, you kind of, you know, you think twice, but this guy does it in half an hour, three
you
clubs.
You know what, you could do it in half an hour at the same time you listen to this podcast. It's about half an hour too, so match made in heaven.
Absolutely.
Enjoy the episode.
Now, the government is bringing back the three strikes law. With some changes, the three-stage system of increasing consequences for repeat serious offenders was repealed by the previous Labor government. The new version will add a new strangulation and suffocation offence, and it will only apply to sentences above 24 months. With us now to discuss this and other issues is the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning, Corin.
Can you point us and listeners to the evidence behind this legislation that says it will help reduce offending?
Well, what I'd say is that we've got the counterfactual, which is it was repealed under the previous government and we saw a 30% increase in violent crime. It wasn't the only thing that the government did or failed to do that led to higher crime, but I'd say to you, we're not prepared to live with higher levels of violent crime and we want to try this.
I appreciate all that, but where is the, I mean, you're a government that has really been critical of the previous government for launching a lot of proposals and doing a lot of things and not following through and not having evidence behind it. Where is the evidence?
Well, the evidence, exactly as I just said, is actually in the previous government without it, we've had a 30% increase in violent crime. We're focusing this legislation on
serious, repeat, violent,
and sexual offenders.
That's why we have evidence. I mean, we research this to see what's causing it. Can you point me to any studies, any papers? Anything?
Well, I can. There's evidence sitting, say, in California. There's evidence sitting in the previous administration's results, which actually led to a massive increase in violent
crime. What's the study in California? Because the evidence I've seen suggests it's inconclusive as to whether it works.
Well, I wanted to say to you, Corin, we're going to restore law and order, and we're putting this in place because when you are a victim of someone who is a serious violent or sexual offender, which is what this is targeted against, I don't care that it saves one person from avoiding that trauma. That is what it's about. I'm on the side of victims. That's what this legislation is designed to do.
No one will disagree with that.
And we're going to do it.
No one will disagree with that. And if it does that, great. But I'm just coming back to the point of principle around introducing legislation based on evidence, and they're not being
evidence. Well, the point of principle is actually making sure we restore law and order and New Zealanders get to feel safe in their own homes and businesses and communities. That's what this is about. We are targeting very serious violent and sexual offenders. And, you know, go out and talk to victims who have actually been, victims of these offenders. I can tell you it is incredibly traumatic. It is incredibly tragic and sad. And so the reality is we are making an intervention here to say for those offenders, that actually there's going to be some serious consequences. And there needs to be because I'd sooner have those people in prison off our streets and New Zealanders feeling safer.
But the argument from lawyers that we've talked to this morning is that there are better ways. This is the argument, right? The evidence suggests there are better ways than this, and therefore you would have more people protected and safe if you did other things such as focus on addiction services, mental health, rehabilitation.
And Corin, we can do all of that, but I'm sorry, we are drawing a line under serious repeat offenders of violent and sexual offending. That has to stop. And so this is one of the tools that we have. There's a suite of things, as you know, that we've been doing to make sure that we restore law and order in New Zealand. And let's be really clear, it's lovely that the conversations are happening, but the reality is the results are poor. We've had an increase in violent crime. And so what we've been doing isn't working. Okay. So we are going to try new things in order to get improved outcomes.
Okay. Fast-track legislation. Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, the Auditor General have both criticised this for a number of reasons around transparency and the decision making. Will you drop the provision that allows ministers to have the final say on this?
No, we're going to stop talking about building more roads, more housing, more renewables, actually get on and do it. We want the fast track provisions as a one-stop shop so that we can actually get things built in this country. That is part of the problem in New Zealand, is that we have seen a huge slowdown in actually getting things done. It's come at a huge cost, about $1.3 billion extra a year.
I understand that, but the Parliamentary Commissioner is saying that this bill lacks environmental safeguards, that the three decision-making ministers will be subject to political lobbying. Does this open you up to reputational damage for New Zealand, for the companies involved, that they that there will be allegations flying of bias and cronyism?
No, I disagree. We've got an expert panel that will make considerations around the environment, around iwi, around the economic conditions or economic case for the projects, and then the ministers are empowered to make a decision.
How do you think someone overseas will see it, though? They will see it as this decision made by a minister.
Sorry, Corinne, just breaking up a bit there.
If an overseas company or an overseas country, perhaps one that we've done a free trade agreement with and that has conditions around the environment, how will they view a decision made on a project as made by a panel or made by ministers?
Well, what I'm just saying, Corinne, is we'll give consideration to all of the concerns around the economics, the environment, the social concerns of any project. But I'm sorry, but we are going to get stuff built in this country, and we are not doing that at the moment. We have calcified and stultified the system to such a degree that we can't get things done. And we can keep talking about more roads, we can keep talking about more housing, talking about more renewables, or we can get on and actually get it done. So where we have projects of regional or national significance, we are going to fast track them.
I understand you're going to do that, but you'll accept
we're doing something different.
I understand that, but you will accept then, according to the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, that that will come at the cost of the environment.
Disagree. A fast track is actually how we get more infrastructure to deal with climate change. It's actually how we get more renewable energy in place, more wind farms, more geothermal plants, more solar energy plants. That's a good thing for us and for our environmental challenges.
Okay, could I just ask you quickly about the story that Joe Moir has been running this morning concerning assisted dying? Do you support the idea of a review? Well, the review's mandatory, but that of perhaps extending the current provisions beyond, say, the 6 months or less to live, so liberalising it further?
Well, look, again, you know, what we've got is a statutory requirement to review the End of Life Choice Act. That is something that a team will look at over the coming months as part of that process. I don't express a view one way or another. It's really up for that review team to look at that.
If you had the opportunity to vote on that legislation, which way would you have voted?
Oh, I think I articulated my point of view at the time. Personally, it was a personal choice, a conscience vote. But the reality is that the Act is there, and I want to make sure that we follow the requirements of the Act. That conversation's happened, the debate's been settled.
What was your position? I mean, New Zealanders are interested.
Oh, my personal position, as I articulated at the time, was it wasn't something I voted against it. But the point is, it is now our statutory part of our law. It's now settled. We've had that debate. We've had that discussion. And it's really important that we do the statutory requirement to review it. And that'll be done by a smart team. David Seaman will be involved, our health minister at the moment. Shane Retty is putting the terms of reference together for that review, making sure that we meet all of our obligations around that.
And just to be clear, the government wouldn't pick this up. Obviously, if you opposed it, you're probably not that keen on liberalising it further. So, I mean, there's a difference in cabinet. So this would not be a government proposal going forward. It would have to be a members' bill?
Well, again, what we've got is we've got a statutory requirement, quite rightly, to review the Act and see how it's functioning and what can be improved and what needs to be changed. As I said, the terms of reference are just being developed by the Health Minister, and that review process needs to go forward. But this, we've had the debate, we've had the discussion, the law is settled, and it's important that law is functioning the way that it's intended to.
Well, hospice leaders and the architect of New Zealand's assisted dying law are calling for major changes to the End of Life Choice Act when it comes up for review later on this year. Health Minister Shane Retty is drawing up the terms of reference for the review with the help of coalition partners, which includes, of course, ACT leader David Seymour, who campaigned and successfully passed through Parliament the country's assisted dying laws. Two areas both Mr. Seymour and hospice leaders say need change, or at least clarity, the so-called gag clause, which prevents doctors from telling patients about the option for assisted dying, and the requirements that a terminally ill person applying to use the intervention has 6 months or less to live. Our political editor, Jo Moyer, has been looking into the review for us, and she is with us now in the Wellington studio. Morena, Jo.
Good morning, Ingrid.
Okay, tell us more about the issues likely to come up in this review and the rationale for change. This was always going to be reviewed after a bit, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So this review was written into the Act when it passed through law. So having spoken to quite a few people about this issue, there seems to be three things that are really coming up as, I guess, what will likely be kind of raised through that submission process when it comes about later this year. The first one is that so-called gag clause. So this is about preventing doctors from informing patients of the option in front of them, which when you think about it is a bit of an interesting one because, you know, doctors have a responsibility and an obligation to present what is available for patients when they go and see a doctor. And while assisted dying is now legal, it's not something that is able to be put forward in front of people. Now, of course, there is an argument around that, and this argument is made by Wayne Naylor, who is the Chief Executive of Hospice New Zealand, that, you know, there's a challenge there because you don't want doctors to be sort of suggesting this to their patients. But at the same time, there is this obligation for them to be putting it forward. And then you also have Tina McCafferty, who's the Chief Executive of Totara Hospice. Now, this is the only hospice in the country that actually allows assisted dying to take place on site on their premises. She makes the point that, you know, this law is currently at odds with the responsibilities of doctors in terms of healthcare options. So that's certainly an interesting one that will play out, I think, in that submission process. The other, of course, which was mentioned, is this only having 6 months or less to live being a requirement. Now, David Seymour says that for him, that is the single biggest issue currently with the assisted dying law. He made that be put into the legislation at the time at the request of the Green Party in order to get the votes he needed to get that law across the line. His argument is that there is basically a group of people that are suffering. He's talking about people who have, for example, Huntington's, motor neuron disease, who could have access to this but don't because of that requirement around the 6 months. So that's another one that's going to come up there as well. Interestingly, Tina McCafferty from Totara Hospice said that prognosis is an art and a science and doctors won't always get it right. So that's something to consider as part of this as well. Now, the third one I will just mention is an advanced directive. So this is giving access to those who may suffer, for example, from dementia who want to make a decision ahead of time. Now, Glenn Marshall, who is from Napier, he has spoken to me at length about this. His profoundly intellectually disabled son, Amon, died last year after having palliative care. Now, he knew that his son would never qualify for this. However, he's really motivated to fight for better assisted dying laws to ensure that those people can have options when they are of sound mind to make those decisions. He says there's a quote-unquote dementia tsunami that's already arrived, and there's thousands of people across the country who have already lost that ability to qualify for assisted dying, and he says that that's something that should be looked at as part of this review.
So what is the actual process for the review? You mentioned the submission process, so did the public get a say?
Yeah, so at the moment we've got the Health Minister, Shane Rettie, who is working out the terms of reference that will be set for this review. Now, he is talking with coalition partners, so that includes ACT leader David Seymour, will include New Zealand First and other ministers as well. Once those terms of reference have been set, they will be published. The Ministry of Health will conduct this review and will consult, and submissions will be able to be made. Both of those hospice chief executives I've mentioned have said that they will be submitting in that process, and no doubt there will be others as well. There will then be a report back to Parliament. Now, there's no requirement for a debate on that report, but the recommendations that will come out of it will likely be picked up by a backbencher MP. Now, it has been suggested to me that that might be an ACT Party backbench MP, and they will turn those recommendations into a members' bill. Now, the reason it needs to go through that process is because David Seymour's made it really clear that there's a conflict of conscience within Cabinet. So basically, you've got people sitting around the Cabinet table who are very split and divided about these laws and when they got put in and how they voted on them. Bear in mind, Shane Rettie, the Health Minister, actually didn't support the End of Life Choice Act when it went through Parliament. So there's not actually going to be an avenue for government to necessarily act on this, which is why David Seymour thinks it will end up going through that members bill process, which of course can take years. So it's kind of interesting to not have an avenue where these recommendations can be dealt with by the government when the government is conducting the review and making sure that, you know, all of these voices are heard. It could sit there for some time.
Okay, now hundreds of New Zealanders have used the assisted dying legislation since it was implemented in 2021. You've got some of those numbers for us?
That's right. So this is as of the 31st of January this year. There had been 1,775 applications for assisted dying. Of those, 980 were approved and 681 of those applicants followed through on it. The assisted dying service says that on average from time of an application being made by someone to written approval being received by that person, it's about a 4 to 6 week process. Now, as part of this, Wayne Naylor, who is the Chief Executive of Hospice New Zealand, he says the assisted dying laws are up for debate and review, but he's also told RNZ that he thinks that palliative care continues to need to be the actual real focus from the government. So he said assisted dying is working okay, there's probably a few tweaks that are needed to fix it, but the whole palliative care and hospice sector, he says, is desperately in need of more funding and workforce. So last year, approximately 34,000 people died from a predictable death, and all of them, he says, would have benefited from some palliative care. But of course, there are discrepancies. So in the rural community, for example, isolated communities, that palliative care is not easily accessible. So whilst we're having this discussion about assisted dying and the review around that, he was making a point that we need to also be thinking about how palliative care can be better accessed as well.
And what issues have you had with in terms of conversations around palliative care?
So, interestingly, going back to Glenn Marshall, he has described the way that his son, Amon, died within palliative care as quote-unquote barbaric, with many interventions. Now, that includes things like the cessation of foods and fluids, which takes place during that process. He's objected to this palliative sedation therapy, which is used within palliative care at the end of someone's life. He says that it's used so freely, yet there's not really any rules and restrictions around that compared to what you have with assisted dying, and he believes the two interventions are the same. Now, just to be clear, that opinion isn't shared by Wayne Naylor or Tina McCafferty from the hospices. They both describe palliative sedation therapy as a mechanism strictly for relieving suffering and distress, and they say it's the underlying illness that ends up being the cause of death, not anything that is done by palliative care. Now, Wayne Naylor, he does acknowledge that there is a person who may die a little bit sooner as a result of that therapy, but says that is a secondary consequence, whereas the primary aim of assisted dying is always to end a person's life with that life-ending medication. Just to add a bit more context, Tina McCafferty, she adds that the cessation of food and fluids that happens, which was something Glenn Marshall felt really strongly against in terms of his son's death and how that played out, she said that's often because a person's body's at the point of death that it can no longer cope with processing either of those things. She says there's a common sort of mistake and misconception that those things have been actively withdrawn from a person, but she says that's not the case. It's actually because the body can no longer process them. So, in saying all of that, Tina McCafferty does say the country probably needs to have a better look at palliative sedation, and she says there is elements of it which includes the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatments, and that's an issue probably that needs to be discussed further. Mm. We've now, of course, got both David Seymour and the Health Minister holding the view too that palliative sedation therapy is a different issue to what we're talking about with assisted dying. They don't want to see those things conflated. This and many other issues will, of course, continue to be thrashed out in the coming months, and it's going to be a wait and see as to what recommendations will come out of it and whether any of them will be implemented anytime soon.
2,500 junior doctors say they'll walk off the job on May the 7th, describing pay options offered by Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand as unacceptable. The doctors' union says the latest offer represents a pay cut or a pay freeze for nearly 600 registrars. Health New Zealand declined an invitation to speak to us this morning, instead releasing a statement saying it is focusing on ongoing good faith bargaining. It said it has guaranteed that no resident medical officer will receive a pay cut and hopes a strike can be avoided, but it concedes it is making contingency plans for May 7th. On the line is the Resident Doctors Association National Secretary, Deborah Powell. Good morning.
Good morning, Corin.
So explain to me how some are getting cuts and some aren't. Just explain to us that.
Okay, so the vast majority of our members would get a pay rise, quite a significant pay rise, in fact, between 15 and 20%. But to pay for that, we believe, 600 registrars will take a pay cut, so their salary will drop. And unfortunately, those registrars are in shortage specialties. So it's a bit of a double whammy for us. We don't believe any resident doctor should take a pay cut. But when it affects shortage specialties as well, places like radiation oncology, psychiatry, public health, and of course general practice, where we are having a lot of difficulty attracting and retaining doctors to work. So it really is a double whammy.
When Health New Zealand says it has guaranteed that no resident medical officer will receive a pay cut, what do they mean then?
They are talking about grandparenting. They've said they won't cut the pay of people currently in those jobs, but resident doctors move job every 6 months, so the pay cuts will affect registrars who are in those training programs now, who then rotate into a job, or those people who are looking to start work. So our general practice registrars will start in February, and they would start on a lower salary than they are receiving now.
How quickly can they move up salary?
We get annual increments, so it would take another year before they would get an increase, but that second increase still wouldn't get them to where they are now for some of our registrars.
So what we're talking about here is that those graduating, or those coming through the system in the early stages of their career, they are facing the prospect of coming in at lower rates.
Yeah, not necessarily early. For our general practice people, for instance, we often get fourth or fifth year doctors going into general practice. So they're not necessarily early in their career, but they are certainly at the beginning of it. If you are changing runs, so we do that, as I say, every 6 months, you're also at risk. So it's quite a spectrum of types of doctors. They're all registrar positions, so they're all positions where we are training to become specialists, become consultants, and of course you have to be a resident doctor at least 2 years before you can pick up one of those jobs.
All right, big move to go on strike though for any doctor. Are you absolutely confident that this is not going to put people's lives at risk?
Absolutely. Now, I need to make it clear, we got a 95% vote in favour of this strike. So the feeling of the resident doctors, despite the fact that most of them will get a pay rise, is very high. That they just see this offer in totality. And it's not just about the pay cut, but there are other elements of it as well. But they just don't see this as fair. However, our senior doctor colleagues will still be in the hospitals. And of course, people who aren't members of the RDA will also be working. So there will be doctors in all our hospitals. And so people shouldn't be.
There won't be as many, though, will there? It will put strain on, won't it? And that is the problem, you know, it increases the risk for mistakes and for people to get overlooked.
Absolutely. We've been running 500 vacancies of resident doctors for a couple of years now, at least 500 vacancies. And yeah, the strain is showing. So even more reason why we shouldn't cut their pay. We've got to be able to attract and retain these people so that we actually do have a workforce, not just now, but in the future. So yeah, the stakes are high. They certainly
are. Are you signalling that this is ongoing strike action or just a one-off at this stage?
We're certainly balloting our members to engage their appetite in further industrial action. We're hopeful we'll get settlement of this at mediation next week, obviously, and you know, good faith bargaining is continuing. But we are certainly gauging our members' feeling about further action.
I mean, what would you say? There will be people who are arguing, you know, that everybody right across the public sector, every sector is taking a hit at the moment and having to tighten their belts. Why, you know, obviously health very important and right at the front of that queue probably, but nonetheless should be making cuts as well.
Not to people's pay when it means that we won't have doctors in the future to care for our mental health and addiction patients, for our cancer patients. When we've had to shut down training in Dunedin because we don't have enough radiation oncologists, and yet that's one of the groups who are going to get a pay cut. A pay cut to these people means we won't have doctors, and that's not okay. So, yeah, this is a very serious situation. We do understand the financial parameters, but
when you say we won't have doctors, what do you mean? That they will leave, go overseas?
Yeah. If we've got residents at the moment who are looking at radiation oncology as an option, who are now going, well, I better train in Australia, or I'm going to consider another option. That's what it means to them. We're talking thousands of dollars a year that they will drop in pay. And unfortunately, that's just not attractive.
Opening statements are done and the criminal case against Donald Trump is underway in New York. The prosecution argued that a hush money payment to former adult film star Stormy Daniels was, quote, election fraud, pure and simple. Trump's lawyers hit back, arguing there's nothing illegal about trying to influence an election. That is just democracy. The AP's Philip Crowther is at the courthouse and he joins us now. Good morning, Philip. Welcome to the program. Can you talk us through those opening arguments, what actually happened today? There was a witness on the stand too.
Yeah, short day in court, 25 minutes for the opening statement for the prosecution. And I think you summarized it pretty well there. Essentially, what they are saying is that this was not just a president or a president in waiting at the time who falsified some records. This was part of a much bigger plan, a scheme to illegally influence the presidential election of 2016, to hide those hush money payments to a former porn star, to keep her story of an alleged relationship with Donald Trump out of the headlines. This is a view of the prosecution. Essentially, what we're seeing here and what we've seen displayed here on this Monday was a roadmap from the two sides. Donald Trump's defense team, his lawyers, are essentially saying, well, first of all, hush money payments are not illegal. That is certainly true. Trying to somehow influence an election is not illegal either. They're also saying that these payments were entirely legal and that in some parts, Donald Trump didn't even know about them. So these are some of the aspects we'll be hearing much more detail about over the next 6 or 8 weeks. It's going to be a pretty long trial. Mm-hmm. First, though, we already saw the first witness. It's David Pecker. He was the CEO of the National Enquirer. This is a tabloid that allegedly used a catch-and-kill scheme. This means that it would pay for stories, or rather it would be paid for stories that it would then not publish, the types of stories that could hurt somebody like Donald Trump, and that he and his publication worked directly together with the man who was trying to be president. We'll hear a lot more from him, from the first witness, this Tuesday.
So what are the possible outcomes for Trump here and in terms of how it will affect his campaign?
Well, his campaign is a logistical problem for him. It's as simple as that. He has to be in court every time it is in session. That is 4 days a week, pretty much 8 hours each day, except for some exceptions. That means that he can only be on the campaign trail really on Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays, and maybe in the evenings. Now, of course, what Donald Trump does particularly well as a candidate is he turns his court appearances almost into campaign events. He does speak to the cameras before he enters the courtroom. He speaks to them again when he leaves the courtroom, but it doesn't give him the possibility to organize any large-scale rallies across the country. And that's something that he complained about today, that this is a court case that he says is politically motivated, that is keeping him, the leading candidate, out of the spotlight and away from the campaign trail. That's the immediate impact it has on his campaign. I think, though, more importantly, first of all, there would be the possibility, of course, of a jail sentence or maybe just a fine for him if he's found guilty. But maybe more painfully for him, over the next 6 to 8 weeks, that's how long we expect this trial to last, there'll be a lot of salacious detail about his private life, but also about how he runs his campaigns, how he runs his business, that will be laid out in public right in front of him.
To golf, and the world's best speed golfer, New Zealander Jamie Reid has won the national speed golf title at Fitzroy Golf Club near New Plymouth at the weekend. Now, scores in speed golf are calculated by adding your carded score, this is as in normal golf, with the time it took you to complete your round. On the PGA Tour, the best players average a score of about 69 and usually take up to 6 hours to complete their rounds. Jamie Reid's opening round this weekend was a 68. He did it in 31 minutes and 3 seconds for an unofficial world record score of 99.03. Jamie Reid is with us now. Kia ora, good morning and congratulations.
Good morning, thank you.
All right, you got to help people out here who don't understand how this works. I mean, for a start, I want to know, how many golf clubs do you carry? Are you literally sprinting the whole way?
Yeah, so in speed golf, you're allowed up to 7 clubs. Obviously, the more clubs you take, you have to carry those there, so it becomes a bit of a heavier run. But in the weekend, I just took 3 clubs. So I just took driver, 7-iron, and then gap wedge, and I just putt with my gap wedge and just hit like a belly wedge, so the ball sort of rolls like a putter.
Right, and so where does the emphasis lie here? Because you could be the fastest runner, but if you can't get good distance on your shots, so how long do you pause before each shot?
Yeah, personally, I just sort of get over the ball and take one breath and then just swing it. So by the time I get to the ball and I've hit the ball, I'm sort of gone within 5 seconds. So it takes the whole mental side of golf out rather than thinking about sort of what you're doing with your swing. You don't have time to think about that. All I'm thinking about is how tight I am, really.
What if you shank it into the trees?
Well, that's it, yeah. So you've got to put a premium on being able to hit it straight, because if you hit it straighter, then you don't have to run as far and therefore your time's going to be better. So you need to make sure that you're taking clubs so that you can hit straight. And obviously, yeah, you don't want to be hitting the hosel at all.
So what are you doing with that calculation around time versus shots here and, you know, trying to balance that out? How does that work mentally?
Yeah, I mean, it's just trying to work what's best for you. There's some people that come from a running background, and so they'll take less clubs and try and run faster and make up their score there. Otherwise, there's others that come from a golfing background, and they'll take more clubs and try and put a better golf score on the ground. So, you know, it's that balance of trying to find what's best for you. Personally, for me, I only take 3 clubs, which is pretty lightweight, really. A lot of people take around 3 or 4, and then I just try and run as fast as I can and just make sure my golf hangs on for dear life.
So you're playing on a full regulation course here? This is a big course, normal course?
Fitzroy is only a par 68, so I guess it's shorter than your normal course. But I'm still running 6.5, 7K, so...
So you shot a 68, so you shot par?
Yeah, so it's par 68.
Do you get birdies? You've ever knocked in a albatross or something on your way?
What did I, in six, had 5 birdies and 5 bogeys, I think, in my 68, so... There's still room for improvement there, I guess, with 5 bogeys on the scorecard. But every now and then I make the odd eagle, but there were no eagles this weekend.
Yeah. Look, I suppose the bonus is you can squeeze in a round of golf and not ruin your day.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's a lot of the times we'll go out and play that first slice, and, you know, at the moment we'll be finished by 7 o'clock and be back home with the family at 7:30 in the morning like nothing's happened. So makes it a bit easier for us.
I suppose, though, Jamie, the thing is you have to play when no one else is there, because you drive people crazy if you were running past them all the time.
Yeah, correct. So we try and play either early morning or later, just before the sun goes down, so that it's not too many people out there. Otherwise, you're just having to pass everyone and it just becomes slow golf anyway.
Does it help not having to make all that thinking? People talk about golf being such a mental game and psyching themselves out. Does it help?
Absolutely, it does. Like, people would be surprised if they went out there and you don't have to necessarily run around. If you just jogged around or did a power walk and just got straight over the ball and hit it straight away without even doing a practice swing or thinking about anything, they'll find that their golf's just as good or if not better than what it is when they play traditional golf. Personally, for me, when I hit tee to green, I hit it better when I play speed golf as opposed to traditional golf. But then the short game's quite hard with the chipping and the putting because you haven't got many clubs. The feel of it can be quite tough as well, so that's where you sort of lose a few shots. But yeah, tee to green, you'll find that you don't lose much at all.
And you play a little bit of slow golf, as you call it, as well, do you?
Yeah, I do a little bit every now and then. Yep. Yeah, so I don't take 14 clubs. I normally just take about 9 clubs when I play slow golf.
All right, so now I want to know an unofficial world record. Why is it unofficial?
So it has to be I think it has to be 6,000 yards on the scorecard for it to count as an official, and we were playing like 5,300 yards or something like that. It's like, I said, a little bit shorter. But it is what it is. I can play what's in front of me.
All right. Well, I look forward to talking to you perhaps when you get the official world record at some other later date, because I can't take it from what you're saying. You're not going to be giving this up anytime soon.
No, I'll keep at it. Yeah, I'll keep at it.
Well, good luck. And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from.
The Antarctic Turn. RNZ National.